MacCast, Saturday, September 9th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we are just a few days away from Apple's big event on next Tuesday, or depending upon when you listen to this, maybe even right now. Apple is announcing their new products. Specifically, we're expecting the announcement of the next iPhone, and we are going to be getting into a few stories about that, including a big kind of leak that happened late this week, actually just today or yesterday, I think it was on Friday, as I record this. So we're going to be getting into that a little bit and talk about the ramifications of that and maybe a little change that I'm going to make here on the MacCast related to leaks and rumors. We're also going to talk about just what is expected in terms of demand for the iPhone 8. Also, a little bit about the new venue. Actually, that's going to be a big story in and of itself on Tuesday. We get our first look at the Steve Jobs Theater because they are holding the event there, as we mentioned on the last show. So we have a little more details about the Steve Jobs Theater, and what we can expect when Apple shows that off during the live stream. Also, some more information about the HomePod, something happening with Apple Music Festival, and a little bit on another play Apple is making for potentially some original content. We'll have to look into it. But Apple is maybe going to grab a big new property, or they're at least in the mix for it. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback on AirPods, also a question about iTunes Match, and a few little odds and ends, kind of a listener question grab bag from one of you. So we'll answer a few different questions there, and that'll kind of round out the show. So let's just dive right into the big news this week. Happened toward the end of the week. Like I said, I didn't want to bury the lead this time around, but there was a big leak of the iOS Gold Master, the last version of iOS. It was not out and available for developers yet, but there were some URLs that were leaked out to the media, I think 9to5 Mac and Mac Rumors, among some of the other bloggers out there like Stephen Trotton Smith and Guillerme Rambo. They got their hands on these, although I think the URLs also were posted on Reddit. So it's not entirely clear how all of these sources found the URLs, but as far as where the URLs came from, they seem to be official Apple URLs. They're kind of hidden URLs that Apple gives out to select people so that they can get a look at the Gold Master early. We were expecting a Gold Master release actually out for developers. I expected it to come out this week. Maybe it's going to be out early next week, but probably not. Probably we're just going to see it as the final release after the announcement. But as to where it came from, a lot of theories floating around online. John Gruber said in a post that he is, quote, nearly certain that this wasn't a mistake. It wasn't an accident that these got out. The URLs were kind of pretty cryptic, so they would have been pretty hard to figure out. But he says, I'm nearly certain this wasn't a mistake, but rather a deliberate malicious act of a rogue Apple employee. And it caused quite an uproar on Twitter Friday night into Saturday morning. A lot of people very upset, obviously. A lot of Apple employees upset at sort of ruining the surprise, because this release specifically has a lot of stuff related to the next iPhone, the new iPhone, which we're just days away from getting the actual details. I know we've speculated and been talking about the iPhone 8 for the last year or so, maybe a little bit longer, and we've heard all kinds of different rumors and things, but we're getting to that point where we're going to know exactly what is going to come out. And so many people are feeling like, you know, these leaks, especially this late one that's giving up a lot of the specific details, tend to ruin the surprise. And I totally get that. I totally understand it. Some people are going so far, though, as to sort of blame the system, blame the people that are into finding out about rumors, blaming the sites that cover these rumors as being part of the problem. And for me, that starts to get a little bit murky. I have very great compassion and respect for the awesome teams of people that Apple who develop these things and who maybe feel like this kind of stuff ruins the moment for them. And I totally understand that some people out there don't like leaks or the culture that leaks create. And they see the existence of these sites as part of the problem. Personally, I'm not convinced that I would take it that far, but that's just me. Again, I understand people who don't like that. But I'm not convinced that if, just taking these sites away would solve the problem. I don't think it would make the culture go away. I think there'd be other outlets that were found for this. We've got social media, we've got all sorts of things, and there is a huge demand for it within our community. Whether we like it or not, some people really like these. Personally, it doesn't really ruin the surprise for me. I get intrigued by it. I don't put too much stock in it. I think if you've listened to the show, I often warn that until Apple actually announces it or tells us something exists, not to really trust it. I think the difference this time around is it is coming directly from a source inside Apple, right? And this wasn't supposed to get out there. It was probably leaked by someone internally inside Apple, whether it was a disgruntled employee or we don't know the actual details. It's just speculation at this point. But yeah, it's that sort of thing is not kind of fun. But now the information is out there, it's exposed. And I don't know if berating on or targeting or being angry at the sites that are actually covering the information now that it's in the wild is necessarily the right thing to do. I think we can make choices about what content we choose to consume, and I think it's pretty clear which sites cover which kinds of content and which ones do rumors and which ones don't. And if you're following people on Twitter, you can probably quickly or Facebook or other social media, you can probably pretty quickly figure out who is going to expose leaked information. I mean, certainly if you don't want to know about what's going to be in the next iPhone, don't follow guys like Stephen Troughton Smith or Guillermo Rambo or Sonny Dixon. I mean, these are well-known people in our community that are looking for leaks, or don't follow 9to5 Mac or and these are great sites, and maybe you want other articles that are there, but you can kind of figure out from headlines what's being leaked. So I think we have a certain amount of responsibility just to decide which content we want to consume, make choices about that. And if you don't want to know about leaks, don't read about them, don't follow them. If you do, fine, do. That's just something you like. Here on the MacCast, we cover rumors. We talk about them, I think, because it's part of our community. And there is a large contingent of you out there who want to know this stuff and don't feel like the surprise is ruined for you. For those of you that do feel like this is kind of ruining the surprise, I've heard from you as well. And I think maybe what I'm taking away from this kind of big leak here is maybe it's time to kind of handle how we cover these things a little bit differently. And I totally get that. And I can agree with that part of this conversation. So I think for my part, moving forward, I'm going to try to do a better job. And you can let me know if I'm doing that. Try to do a better job of separating the rumor and leak information, those kinds of stories in the podcast, give you maybe warnings up front, kind of like we do if I was going to talk about a movie and was going to give up spoilers, I would give you a spoiler alert. So maybe what we need to have is sort of a rumor alert so that we are going to be getting into that. And then you can, if you don't want to know that information, easily skip over it. You remember I use chapters in the MacCast, so if your podcast app supports that, either MP3 chapters or AAC chapters, if you're using the Apple Podcast app, it should be pretty easy for you to just jump over those sections of the show and get to the parts that you do want to listen to. So I'm very open to your feedbacks and you're very open to your thoughts and feedback on this. So send me an email, maccast@gmail.com, but I think that's what we're going to try to do. So because this big GM leak happened, we are going to cover it now. I'm going to be getting into that. So if you don't want to know about the very latest leaks for the next iPhone, what we've been calling the iPhone 8, you're going to want to skip ahead now. So I'll give you a second to do that. All right. For those of you who are still with me, first thing that we kind of heard this week is that the iPhone may only come in three colors, not the sort of six different color options that we have today. So if you're familiar, Apple currently with the iPhone 7 sells a jet black, a silver, a gold, a rose gold, and the product red. The new colors, which have been possibly confirmed by a leaked SIM tray component parts or leaked SIM tray component parts, it's looking like it's going to come in black, silver, and then the new blush gold, kind of the new shade of the gold that's, I think, halfway between the gold and the rose gold color, kind of a copper color some people have referred to it as. That looks like that will make up the third color of the next generation iPhone. And then, like I said, this big gold master leak that happened late Friday, early into Saturday, this has given us the most new details about what we might expect to see on Tuesday. There's some new wallpapers in there, kind of designed to show off the deep contrast colors of the new OLED display that the iPhone is expected to come with. And this includes a new set of retro six color design that takes cues from the old Apple logo. And I absolutely love the look of this thing. It's kind of got the six stripes going across the middle of the iPhone. And it is expected that all of the models, the updated versions of the 7 and 7 Plus, along with the new iPhone 8, iPhone Edition, all of those are expected to get OLED displays. And speaking of that naming, you know, we've been going back and forth a lot on the naming. What is it going to be called? Up until now, I've been referring to the newest iPhone as the iPhone 8 and the updated ones as the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus. It's looking like from the GM leak, we actually have the official naming, which is expected to be actually the iPhone 8, the iPhone 8 Plus, and the iPhone 10, I'm assuming in reference to it being the 10th anniversary version of the iPhone. So the one we've been in the past referring to as the iPhone 8 or the iPhone Edition, it's looking like it's going to get the name iPhone 10, and Apple is going to just simply jump over the S series. Now, I'm not sure if this means Apple is not going to do the alternating S series thing anymore, or if this is just a one-time thing, but it is looking like it's going to be the iPhone 10, and they are using the X instead of the numeral 10, just in case you were wondering. But I'm going to call it the iPhone 10, not the iPhone X, because I don't think that's correct. Few more information about the display. The display we know is going to be OLED. It is now looking like it's confirmed to be a True Tone display, and the resolution will be 1125 by 2436. And it is going to have the full edge-to-edge with the little notch design and the what is supposedly being referred to internally at Apple as the little ears. So where the status information goes is going to be to the left and right of that little notch in a little new area. And we started to see from this latest leak some images and some animations and things on how that might work. And so what we're seeing now is the charging icon is going to be over on the right. It actually going to have a cool little new animation that when you plug it in, it goes from just the battery indicator and kind of becomes larger. It gets a little lightning charging icon next to it. Or I think that actually may be part of the icon itself. But there's a cool little animation that was leaked by Guillermo Rambo. And then also we're starting to see images of a double height status bar, because obviously you can't go all the way across. So in some instances, you'll actually have information either slightly above or below the area where the main icons are. So there was one for kind of a status indicator that was sliding back and forth, a little animated bar that went back and forth as it was loading things, very similar to kind of the three-dot loading icon that we get now on the current iPhone. And then also things like the back buttons when you've moved from one app to another, and you have those little back indicators, those are going to be actually on a second line under the main icon. And the time will be shifted over, because normally that sits in the middle. That will be shifted over when you're in various apps to the left-hand ear, and it will gain little colored backgrounds. So it almost becomes like a little pill-shaped icon with a colored background when you have stuff going on in the background. So if you have an ongoing phone call, you know, normally the whole status bar at the top would turn to green. Now you're just going to have a little green color behind the time. Red for recording. I'm assuming blue for, again, when you're using the iPhone in tethered mode and those sorts of things. A number of other people have noted that for some reason Apple has chosen to go with a lot of extra white space in this design, and they are complaining about it a little bit now that these images have been leaked. You know, I kind of feel white space is something in design that is necessary. I guess there's maybe debate over the amount of white space, and especially on something like a phone where screen real estate is a little bit limited, people get a little more critical when there's too much extra white space. I'm kind of holding a reservation until I actually see how apps are laid out, but think of the kind of big title bar design that we've seen with the updated versions of the app stores, stuff that Apple showed off at Worldwide Developer Conference. And that's the kind of look that we're talking about. So I'd be curious to get your take on that. You know, how do you feel about kind of more openness, more white space in the designs? I think I prefer it. I actually kind of like it. It looks nice to me, and I don't mind scrolling a little bit more rather than having or trying to have everything crammed into a tiny space and fit all on a screen. So I actually kind of like it. But Ming-Chi Kuo says the iPhone X models will actually all have black bezels on the front. Again, another attempt to have a better aesthetic design. So we had earlier on seen leaked examples of the white iPhone where it had a white bezel and a white notch. And the question became, you know, that's not really going to blend in very well. It's going to stick out. And a lot of people really didn't like that style. It's looking like all of the phones, regardless of the back color, are going to have, at least according to Ming-Chi Kuo, black bezels. And I think that will look a lot nicer. It'll blend in a lot nicer. That notch almost becomes completely transparent when you have that deep dark black of the OLED display. And personally, I really like the new iPhone design. I think it looks gorgeous all the way around. So even seeing those notches doesn't really bother me, but I like the idea of them sort of blending in a little bit better. On the camera front, it's looking like there may be a kind of cool new feature related to the portrait feature that Apple added with the iPhone 7 Plus. This time around, they're adding something called portrait lighting. It's looking like it's going to be kind of a mode effect for creating DSLR-like shots using the depth sensors and things to simulate different lighting effects. So lighting is a big deal in professional photography, and it's looking like Apple's going to try and simulate that to give you a little bit better portrait shots. And it's looking like it's going to have different modes. There's going to be a contour lighting mode, a natural light mode, a stage light mode, stage light mono, and studio lighting modes. And I'm assuming they're using some of that 3D technology and the 3D sensors, probably some of the AR kit technology as well, to make that happen. We got a lot more detail on the new facial recognition feature that may end up replacing Touch ID. Earlier on, we had heard kind of an internal code name for that as Pearl ID. It's looking like from this latest release, it is going to be simply called Face ID. We even got some possible animations and details of the setup process. Again, from some leaked videos that were posted on Twitter by Guillermo Rambo. My reaction, if you follow me on Twitter, you probably saw it already. I wasn't super thrilled with the design in the look. It looks a little bit cartoony. But, you know, again, I'm reserving judgment till I actually see it in action. It's kind of hard to really tell until you use something what it's like. And it does look like this is just the setup process. So it's not going to be the full experience for when you're just simply unlocking the phone. And I'm kind of okay with that. But basically, it looks like the setup process is very similar to the way you set up Touch ID today. You'll turn on the phone, it'll ask you if you want to turn on the feature, and then it kind of gives you a little target zone. The camera turns on, gives you a target zone where you'll hold it up to your face, and then it will kind of have you rotate your head around so that it can get different angles slowly, you know, up, down, left, right, and you'll try and fill a little ring with little tick marks. I think that's very similar to some of the ways Apple has handled it on the Apple Watch. But basically, you'll do two full Face ID scans so that they can get your whole face in there. Your face during the setup, at least, does need to be unobscured. And it does mention that in the setup screens that it looks like the phone will be aware of whether or not you're looking at the phone. So there is some kind of iris detection or something. It's not iris scanning, but eye detection, basically, so that it knows when you're actually looking at the phone. And I'm assuming that technology will play into how the whole facial recognition and face ID feature works. So that will definitely be part of it. Now, there's another kind of cool feature related to Face ID that has not been exposed before, and I don't know how Apple kept this under wraps, but it's looking like Apple has developed a whole new kind of emoji that they're actually calling Animoji, and it will use the 3D facial recognition to actually capture your facial expressions and apply them to these 3D animated emoji. It's likely driven by Apple's Face Shift technology, which was the company that they acquired back in 2015. They kind of had a process for this, so it will actually map your facial expressions onto a little animated emoji. And I know it sounds gimmicky, but these kinds of things are the things that really make the messaging experience unique on an iPhone. And let's face it, it's the kind of thing that actually drives sales of phones. I have to tell you, I think more Macs were sold because of the photo booth technology than we'd probably care to admit. And I think this one is going to be a big hit with a lot of people. I don't think I'm going to be using it a whole ton, but I certainly will play around with it. And I'm looking forward to seeing it in action. The sleep wake button on the side of your phone may be getting renamed. It's looking like it's simply going to be now called the side button, very similar to the Apple Watch. So I kind of like this idea of Apple standardizing on a lot of the naming and a lot of the functionality with the new side button on the iPhone X will work just like it does with the Apple Watch. So double-clicking the side button will bring up your Apple Pay cards and passes, just like on the Apple Watch. And apparently, you'll also be able to press and hold the side button to invoke Siri, again, very similar to how you would do it with the Apple Watch. So that sort of standardization of the button language, I think, is ultimately a good thing. So that's kind of the latest on the iPhone. We also got from this latest leak a bit more information about the Apple Watch, the LTE Apple Watch, which was being expected. They have an image of it, and it shows a kind of red accent on the digital crown. Now, it's not clear if that means all the LTE watches will kind of have the little red dot instead of the black one, or if it's only specific models, but the one they actually show in the setup process seems to show that. There's also indications that you will be able to add your Apple Watch to your existing cell plan if you opt for the LTE model, of course, at an additional cost, most likely, depending upon your carrier. It will share the same number as your iPhone, and that seems to imply that you actually may be able to take and make calls with your Apple Watch. Earlier rumors had said that that would not be possible, but that may still be possible because your Apple Watch will actually have a phone number assigned to it. So we'll have to see what Apple says about that on Tuesday. And then there were also some references in the latest firmware or software, rather, beta to some new Apple Watch finishes, including a ceramic gray, so maybe an additional color for the Apple Watch Edition models, and a reference to the aluminum brush gold, I'm assuming, so that you can match your Apple Watch to your shiny new iPhone X. And then there also seems to be some indication that we may get updated AirPods. I know this one was kind of hard for me to believe, considering that it's still hard to get your hands on the current generation of AirPods, but there were references to AirPods 1.1 and AirPods 1.2, and the main change seems to be on the charging case, and that is moving the internal charging status LED from inside the case to the outside. And actually, I would really like that feature because having to open the case every time to just check the charging level or check the charging status is a little bit annoying, especially considering the fact that you have that cool feature when you open the case, it pairs with whatever your phone or device is. Sometimes I just want to look at that dot and I don't want the little sheet coming up on my iPhone. So I like the idea of Apple moving that indicator to the outside of the case. But that is all the latest from these rumors. Of course, we're going to find out all the actual details on Tuesday. I'm getting very excited about the event. Again, even in light of all of this information coming out, Apple's presentation of the information, being able to see inside the Steve Jobs Theater for the first time, it's all still very exciting to me. But again, I totally understand those folks for whom this kind of information maybe ruins the surprise a little bit. So hopefully those of you who are with me still wanted to hear this information, and the others, hopefully they've skipped, and let's catch back up with them. So it's looking like, I thought the iPhone 8 was going to be a huge, huge release for Apple. And everybody inside the tech community is thinking Apple is going to sell a metric ton load of the new iPhones. But at least according to a recent survey by Piper Jaffray of about 400 current iPhone owners, it may or may not be that big of a success. They asked a bunch of people who are iPhones, do you plan to upgrade? And it showed that interest in upgrading this year was about the same as it was for the iPhone 7 last year. So the numbers showed that 16% of the people that they questioned planned to upgrade definitely. That was compared to 15% last year. And that 24% versus 29% last year said they would maybe upgrade. Now, the survey still notes that ultimately there could be more demand for the iPhone than these numbers indicate. And I also think that, many people outside of the little tech world bubble that we're in probably don't realize the radical extent of the upgrades and redesign that the new iPhone 8 is going to have, especially considering the fact that a lot of people are still conditioned to the whole S cycle, right? We got the iPhone 7 last year, so this is supposed to be the S series, which is not a big, typically a big leap forward. So if you're not an Apple watcher, if you're not a close follower of Apple technology, you may not be all that interested in upgrading or thinking that you're going to want to upgrade. But when Apple shows off all of the new features, the whole new design, I think a lot of that can change. There's also estimated to be a base of about 330 million iPhone owners right now whose devices are 2 years old or older. And that's typically the point when users will want to upgrade. Now, the piece did note that that's about the same as the number of people that had 2-year-old or older iPhones last year. But because of the significant upgrade changes, more folks are likely to upgrade. So there's a big pool of Apple customers who will probably want to upgrade to the new iPhone. And so overall, they say that after about 12 months with the new iPhone, they expect Apple will have sold about 242 million units, and that's actually a 12% year-on-year increase. So it's not quite the 36% jump that Apple saw when they launched the iPhone 6, but it's a lot better than the somewhat flat numbers that Apple has seen over the past couple of releases, the iPhone 6s and the iPhone 7. So I fully expect that Apple's going to see an uptick in iPhone sales with the launch of these new models. We also got a little more details on the pricing and why this year's model may be a little bit more expensive. Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that a big part of that is the OLED screen, and the fact that Samsung is the sole supplier. So because Samsung is the sole supplier for Apple, they have a little bit more ability to control the price. Typically, when Apple has multiple suppliers, they can kind of pit those suppliers against each other and get a better deal. So Kuo expects that that Apple is paying Samsung about $120 to $130 US per unit. And just so you have a point of reference for comparison, it's believed that they currently pay about $45 to $55 for an iPhone 7 Plus LCD screen. So that's more than double the cost of just the raw component. So of course, Apple is going to have to translate that into a higher selling price for the iPhone so that they can keep the healthy profit margin that they like to get on their devices. And Apple, of course, has reportedly been trying to get OLED production from other companies. They are trying to get deals going with Japan Display and LG Display, but those companies really haven't been set up for OLED production. Their capabilities and volumes are not quite where Apple needs them to be. We've heard about them investing in new plants and factories specifically for companies like LG Display to kind of get them up and running. And again, this is probably a whole effort to ensure that they're not just under the control of Samsung when it comes to orders and pricing. So eventually, I think they're going to get out of this sort of hold that Samsung has on them, but it's probably going to be a year or two before that actually happens. And it's looking like because of those kinds of things, those issues with the displays and the price, and also just the production levels, those displays may cause a delay in the actual release date of the iPhone. So it's still expected that Apple is going to show off the device on Tuesday, that they will likely have pre-orders going up maybe by the end of the week. But we had been looking at when Apple would actually start shipping devices, and it's looking like the updates to the iPhone S or to the iPhone 7 models, what we've been referring to as the S series models, so the iPhone 7S, 7S Plus, those may ship in September. Starting probably September 22nd for those people who pre-order, but the iPhone 8s might not be ready, it's looking like, until sometime in October. And we have this coming from two sources, including Mac Takara and also the Wall Street Journal, who simply reported that the release date could be possibly pushed back about a month. So again, if Apple announces in September, we're looking at maybe an October ship date. So if you're planning on getting a new iPhone 8, Apple's next iPhone, you may be in for just a little bit longer of a wait. As I said at the top of the show, I am super excited about being able to finally get a look inside the Steve Jobs Theater. It's being prepped. Again, we're going to get into some kind of rumors here, so if you don't want the surprise spoiled, you may want to jump ahead. But right now we know that the exterior has its round shape. That's been shown off. I don't think we're giving away anything there. You've got 20-foot glass panels all the way around in that floating disc-shaped silver carbon fiber roof. From the outside, it looks gorgeous, but we have not until now known much about the inside of that theater. We've seen kind of little glimpses from the outside, but we haven't known a lot of details. We do know that it seats about 1,000 people and it's underground, but beyond that, not much. Well, now we're getting our first official look on the inside of that theater, or I guess unofficial, but actual pictures from the inside of the theater that were leaked out through construction crews and other people. And it's giving us a rough idea of the kind of experience that those lucky folks in the media who have been invited to the event are going to get to have. Bloomberg had some of the details, including information that it goes four stories underground. I don't think I had realized it was that deep. There's a set of spiral staircases from the atrium down to a lower level, and we've kind of seen that. But down there, there's also two custom-made rotating elevators. These things are very cool. So typically, a lot of times you'll have an elevator where you have doors on one side on one level, you get in, you go down or up to another level, and then there's doors on the other side that you walk out. Of course, Apple wants to do things a little bit differently, so their elevator is round, it has doors on the one side, and as it descends, it does a 180-degree rotation, apparently, and then you exit from the other side, but through the same doors that you came in. So that sounds really neat. I guess Apple needed its own version of a Wonkavator for its new theater, and that is really cool. And then a big part of these announcements, of course, is the demo area that's opened up to reporters and media so that they can get a hands-on with whatever products are announced. Apple has a cool little, or the Steve Jobs Theater has a cool little trick for that as well, apparently. So folks will go into the theater from, I'm assuming, kind of a lobby area. They will have the presentation, and when they come back out, one of the walls in that area will have slowly retracted back to reveal the demo room. that they can go into after the presentation. And as far as what the experience is going to be like during the presentation, it is going to be a little bit more luxurious than I think reporters are used to. Those 1,000 seats in that theater, yeah, they are big custom leather seats. And inside those seats are power outlets. So they're not going to be actually scrambling around worrying about their battery levels or anything like that. You're going to be able to plug in right there, sitting in a big, comfy leather seat. And they look gorgeous. Some of the leaked pictures of the inside of the theater, of course, attention to detail is something Apple just doesn't miss a beat on. And the Cupertino Public Works Director, Tim Borden, in an article in the San Jose Mercury News, claimed that each one of these custom leather seats cost around $14,000 US. That seems a little bit pricey to me, but I went and confirmed that was what was reported in the article. Again, speculation, but wow. If that's really truly the price, those reporters are getting, their behinds, I guess, are getting a really, really nice custom high-end treatment. So hopefully they all appreciate it, and I'm sure they will, but it's going to be really fun. Again, I'm really super excited to kind of get a look at this, and I'm sure Apple's going to talk about a number of features and things related to the theater and maybe even give us some more details on the campus now that they're actually there on their home turf. It's going to be a really big day for Apple, and I'm really happy for them and happy to see what's going on. We're going to be continuing on with some of the rumors this time around with the HomePods, getting more information about that. That product is expected to be released sometime before the end of the year. In December, we should be able to probably order one and get our hands on one, hopefully. Leaker Guillermo Rambo, the Brazilian iOS developer, has been poking around again in the betas, and he's discovered something that may give us a little bit more indication of how the HomePod setup process will work. This time around, it has to do with the pairing and actually creating a connection and doing that securely. He posted a screenshot that showed a failed connection process, or the message that would come up during a failed connection process, and it indicated that it looks like the iPhone is actually going to be listening for a secret tone, I'm assuming an inaudible tone, from the HomePod, and it's presumably used during setup so that you don't have to manually enter in a passcode, although there is a link at the bottom that says enter passcode manually, I'm assuming if the pairing process for some reason isn't working. Maybe there's too much loud external noise interference or something like that. But the HomePod doesn't have Bluetooth or NFC, which actually kind of seems odd to me, considering the setup process, say, for an Apple TV or something like that. But because it doesn't have that, it looks like Apple's going with kind of an audio method. Now, the only thing about the audio setup that I kind of wondered about, if it is how it was described in this leak, is what about security related to that? And it's funny because I was thinking about that in the same week when we heard about a new kind of security hack, something being called the Dolphin hack, that can affect voice assistant systems like the HomePod or Siri on your phone or any of the other voice assistants from other manufacturers like Google and Amazon. This was discovered by some Chinese researchers, and basically what they discovered is they can take and translate vocal commands that you would normally speak out to control a digital assistant and put those into ultrasonic frequencies that are actually too high for your human ear to hear, but will be picked up and responded to by the microphones and software that are in things like the Amazon Echo and the Apple HomePod. So I don't think that there's much of a security risk here. Again, if someone blasts in one of these ultrasonic things, your HomePod might start going off and doing weird things. I guess if it's tied into home automation systems, there might be some concerns and things like that. Hopefully it's something, now that the research is out there, that companies like Apple and Google can respond to. I fully expect them to kind of look into the technology and figure some countermeasures. But it was an interesting thing nonetheless, and it does kind of show that maybe Apple has already tapped into this for like the setup feature on the new HomePod. If you're a music fan or a fan of live music specifically, there is a little bit of sad news this week. It's looking like Apple is planning on ending the Apple Music Festival, that we're not going to get an Apple Music Festival this year. And it might not be too surprising because typically they announce the music festival in August, and we didn't get that. But for the past 2 years, if you haven't been aware, Apple runs a festival. Last 2 years, it's been called the Apple Music Festival. Before that, they've actually been running it, I think, about 10 years. It was called the iTunes Festival. And the Apple Festival was a 10-day event. It took place at the historic Roundhouse in London, and it had all kinds of famous major acts come in and do live music, and Apple would stream the concerts out over Apple Music. They would also record it, and I think publish a lot of that content on Apple Music and on iTunes. They had acts like Elton John, Amy Winehouse, Paul Simon, Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, Linkin Park, a whole bunch more over the years. Back when it was the iTunes Festival, the festival actually went on for an entire month. But it was kind of a really big deal, and it was how Apple kind of promoted music. But supposedly this past week, the Roundhouse sent out emails saying that the Apple Festival was not going to be hosted in 2017. Now, we don't know if that means Apple's just skipping a year, if the festival's never happening again, whether it's permanently canceled or not. There's a lot of questions about it. And there's also the question that, you know, why is Apple choosing to stop doing it, or why did they not do it this year? And there could be a number of reasons. Apple hasn't said anything officially about it, but speculation is that, you know, Apple this year, if you look at what they've been doing, they sponsored a number of shows and artists, live concert tours. They even sponsored a bunch of venues, or a bunch of artists at venues during South by Southwest. So they may just be kind of shifting gears and kind of spreading out how they're doing artist support and supporting various acts and concerts and making that happen throughout the year. They also now have Apple Music, and more specifically Beats One Radio, which features live concert streams, music, and events and promotions and things like that. So they may be looking to take more of their efforts and flow them into those areas of the business. And they've also been putting together concert films and documentaries for Apple Music. So I do think maybe this is more of a focus on, we're going to distribute and support artists in other ways, and we're going to funnel all of that content and stuff and marketing and promotion into Apple Music and into Beats One Radio. So they're kind of probably thinking, well, we don't need just one festival a year. We've got Apple Music and Beats One, which can sort of serve as a festival throughout the year. And it's very similar to the reasons why they stopped supporting like major trade shows and things like that, like Macworld. They just decided, you know, we've got Apple stores, we're going to do and hold events and things in there and promote stuff that way. I think they're taking a similar approach, somewhat similar approach with the whole Apple Music thing. But still sad to see the Apple Music Festival go away, because I watched a few of those and it was some great stuff. And they also, you know, would give out, there was kind of a lottery for tickets and stuff like that. And if you lived in London or you lived in the area over there, it was kind of a whole experience too. And so it's always sad when one of these things goes away. But again, we don't know if it's permanent. We'll have to wait and see if Apple brings something back or redoes it in future years. For at least this year, it looks like no Apple Music Festival. And then the last thing in the news for this week is a rumor about Apple content. It's looking like, and specifically film content, we know that Apple has been working towards trying to get more original programming, original content. They've been hiring a number of executives. Well, now it's looking like they may want to get access to James Bond. Yes, 007. They are supposedly in a bid, along with other companies like Netflix, Warner Brothers, Sony, Universal, and Fox, in trying to acquire the distribution rights for future James Bond films. This is according to a piece in the Hollywood Reporter. After 2015's James Bond film Spectre, the existing distribution contract for Bond, which was held by Sony, had expired, and it has not been renewed. They've been shopping it around. It's sounding like Warner Brothers is the front runner for picking up the rights, but now apparently both Apple and Netflix are trying to get in on it and may be willing to spend even more than the big studios to get those rights. And why is speculated about in the piece, it seems like a lot of them are feeling there's kind of untapped opportunities or content with the Bond properties and all the stories and things like that. Now, it does seem a little bit odd because MGM still holds the rights to the actual Bond property and licensing, and they seem to only be wanting to do a deal for the distribution. But it could be a longer term play by Apple, knowing that, hey, if we get the distribution rights for the films, maybe in the future we get our foot in the door and we can get additional licensing or maybe outright purchase the property rights from MGM, and then we have access to make other content based on the Bond content and licensing and all of that sort of stuff. So think of maybe opening up different TV series or original programming that goes along in addition with the major released films and funneling that into an Apple original content system. And I think there's no coincidence that Sony being the prior distribution holder and the fact that Apple has hired a bunch of ex-Sony executives, Zach Van Amberg and Jamie Ehrlich, to run their original content program, I think it's not really surprising that they're going after this property. And supposedly, those are the guys that are spearheading Apple's efforts to get these distribution rights. The deal could ultimately be worth several billion dollars or cost Apple several billion dollars. I know we've talked about and reported on the fact that Apple has supposedly put together a $1 billion budget for 2018 for producing original content. This is looking like it would be a separate deal outside of that. So Apple could spend several billion dollars just to get the distribution rights for the Bond films, and they may only be able to release those into theaters. So again, a little bit weird on that part. But this week we also saw Apple adding additional staff and kind of key hires to their video content team, both from Sony and WGN America. Former head of current programming at Sony Pictures, Kim Rosenfeld, is joining Apple as its future head of programming and the lead executive on their documentary series development. Max Aronson, who is a VP of drama development at Sony Pictures Television, and Ali Woodruff, Sony's director of creative affairs, have also recently been hired by Apple. And finally, Rita Cooper-Lee, formerly of WGN America, she was their head of publicity, is also joining Apple to lead its communications for the video content unit. So again, Apple really building out the team with some heavy hitters. We know that they've been shopping around looking for office space in Hollywood, so they're getting pretty serious about this thing. And so I would not be surprised if we hear some sort of announcement about Apple's original content plays in 2018, maybe even earlier, maybe towards the end of the year, we'll start to get a little more details about what Apple is cooking up. But I think it would be a huge coup for them to get the James Bond stuff. And I totally agree that that content is ripe for all kinds of storylines, all kinds of content development. So it would be a really rich property that Apple could potentially tap into, although immediately it doesn't seem like they're going to be able to do that. So we'll have to follow this one and see if they ultimately win those rights, but they're certainly in a bidding war, and there's some heavy hitters. There's a lot of people that are going to be going after this. So it may be a hard win, but it could ultimately be a pretty good win for Apple. Also, kind of on the entertainment front, we got some news on the music side of things. It's looking like Apple is or has gotten a new deal with Warner Music Group that may allow them to pay a little bit less money for the streaming rights to the Warner Music Group catalog. This is according to Bloomberg. Apple has supposedly secured a new deal that will allow it to give the labels 55% of sales versus the rate of 58% that they were currently giving, and the rate could go lower depending upon Apple hitting certain subscriber targets. So the more people Apple gets subscribing to Apple Music, they could get a better deal where they pay a lower percentage. And this was reportedly pushed forward after their rival Spotify also secured a lower rate deal with Warner Music Group, although Spotify is believed to be paying just 52%. So Apple's still paying a little bit more than Spotify, and Apple is supposedly looking to get better deals from Universal and Sony as well, but those talks are reportedly ongoing and nothing has been set yet. Now, one thing about this that the piece doesn't discuss, but that I am really curious about is, you know, ultimately, what does this mean for the artists? Is this going to impact them negatively? Does it affect their cut? It's really the deal between Apple and the labels, and I think whatever the artist gets paid really gets determined out of the label's cut. So I'm really hoping this doesn't impact artists, but you know, some people say it could. So that ultimately may not be a good thing. On the positive side, though, with streaming, overall global sales of music actually grew 5.9% in 2016 to $15.7 billion. You know, I'm not convinced that streaming deals are always good for artists, but it does look like music sales are going the right way. Again, maybe the labels are benefiting more from that than the actual artists, but still, you know, streaming is the way the music business is headed these days. And just like any other economy, you need to adapt to changes in technology. Music is going to adapt to, artists are going to adapt as well. And I think ultimately it'll all pan out. But you know, it's always rough when your business changes a little bit, and especially when pricing starts to go down for things and cuts get a little bit smaller, you know, it gets a little bit rough. So I totally understand that side of it. Again, I'm not a huge music business person, but interesting nonetheless, and Apple is getting a little bit better deal from Warner Music. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Casper. So happy to have Casper back on the MacCast as a sponsor, and that's because we love our Casper mattress. I really wouldn't be telling you this if it wasn't true. I absolutely love it. We've been sleeping on a Casper mattress for over 2 years now. I was surprised actually to figure out it has been over 2 years, and honestly, it is the most comfortable mattress I have ever owned. It feels as good as the day we got it. And surprisingly, my wife will still tell me to this day how much she loves the Casper mattress. And that just shocks me. I mean, how many people do you know who are still talking about how great their mattress is 2 years after they get it? Yeah, it really is that good. We love the mattress because it's a perfect balance between good firm support but still having the right amount of comfort for us. You know, has that give. It's not like sleeping on a rock, but you're supported and you're not going to have, you know, kind of, I don't have sleep issues that I had with my old mattress. So I love that, but I also appreciate how well it has held up. It really feels as good today as it did the day it arrived. My old mattress, it kind of developed, we called it the sinkhole. It was like this atom-sized sinkhole in one side of it, and there is no signs of that with the Casper. It is a truly superior mattress, in my opinion. And Casper says it's an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price, and I would totally agree with that. The product design features a marriage between foam layers for ideal firmness, just the right amount of sink, just the right amount of bounce. Has an affordable price because Casper sells direct to consumers. That's why you can get a great deal. And they offer free shipping and returns to the US and Canada. And best of all, 100-night trial with free, no-hassle returns if you're not happy. So you can try it out, order it. Try it out for 100 nights. If you don't agree with me and what I'm saying, you can return it if you're not happy, and they will happily take it back. No questions asked. You don't have to worry about that. And they have amazing reviews. Go online, check it out. Designed and developed and assembled in the USA, and I think you're going to love it. So go to casper.com/MacCast, and if you use the code MacCast at checkout, you're going to get $50 toward your mattress purchase. So casper.com/MacCast, use the code MacCast, and you're going to save on a great mattress. So big thanks to Casper for their support of the show. Last week, we were talking about AirPods a little bit, and I think I told you That I absolutely love my AirPods. I've probably told you many times that I absolutely love my AirPods. They're one of my favorite earphones, headphones, whatever that I've ever owned. Honestly, I really, really love them. But I recognize that maybe not everybody did, and so I kind of threw out the question because I've heard so many positive things about the AirPod. I said to you, are there any of you who don't like the AirPods, and if you don't like them, why? And I have to say thank you to everybody who emailed in. I got a ton of emails related to this, and we're not going to cover all of them, but I wanted to cover some of the highlights and comments. Many of you agreed that you absolutely love your AirPods, but there were definitely some of you that, for various reasons, they didn't click with you. And some of you tried them out, some of you just preferred an alternate style or something like that. But I have to say, the biggest reason that I heard for not liking the AirPods was not the quality, not the fit, not the price, not even the concern that, oh, I'm gonna lose them, they're gonna pop out, they're gonna fall out, which was an early thing that a lot of people were worried about, but turned out to really not be all that true. I mean, they can pop out, but I have not lost one, and I don't know too many people who have lost one. No, the number one reason I heard from you was that they're just stupid looking. They look dumb. They're not my style. I guess the more polite way, many of you said it was not my style. But I'll admit, I even posted a picture of myself on Twitter. They're kind of goofy looking. I mean, they are. Let's just be honest. You can be goofy looking, although I think culturally, like anything, any new style or something like that, it can look goofy at first and then it kind of becomes a thing. And I think AirPods are quickly becoming kind of a fashion thing and being more accepted. But I totally get that. Unfortunately, I received an email from one person who said, yeah, I was basically made fun of at the gym and decided that it wasn't the product for me. And that kind of peer pressure, that's not cool. I don't like that sort of thing. You shouldn't be making fun of people. The idea of adults being bullied because of the earpods or headphones that they choose to wear, just not cool. That shouldn't be happening. But another legitimate sort of thing related to the fit and finish of it was occasionally snagging on clothing and specifically outerwear. And I've had this problem where you've got a pullover sweatshirt or something like that, and you're taking them off, they can pop off and end up in the sleeve or something like that. So they do fall out that way. And that was listed as a problem or concern or just an annoyance for some people. And it's enough of an annoyance that maybe you just don't like that style. So I totally get that. I totally get maybe not liking the look of them overall and wanting to choose another headphone for that. Color was another one. The fact that they're only available in white, some people like a little more style. Maybe you like something more subdued, like a black or something like that. And Apple currently doesn't offer that. I think if Apple did offer a black version, they would be very successful in terms of sales. But I guess they're not really hurting for that quite yet. So fully expect that at some point Apple may introduce or release some additional colors. But another more feature-related complaint from a number of people was the lack of physical controls. You have some limited control with the whole double tap thing, and now that you can assign double taps to each ear, either skip forward, skip back, or activating Siri, something like that, got a little bit better. But yeah, overall, you don't have play pause buttons, you don't have controls on there without really resorting to using your voice and Siri. And some of you said, I'm just not that comfortable with using Siri commands to do a number of the controls. And for that, there were many of you that gave some alternatives to products that you liked. So I wanted to share some of those. I don't have personal experience with any of these, but the couple different headphones that were re recommended, ones that I've heard many people say that they absolutely love are the Braggy Dash headphones, and specifically the Dash Pros. Again, I'll have links to all of these in the show notes at mattcast.com. They're a little bit more expensive than the AirPods at $329, but they do have onboard controls on them and some additional features like noise cancellation. That was another one, another complaint about the AirPods that many people noted, that in noisy environments they can be pretty hard to hear, or it can be hard to hear things, or you have to turn up the volume. And I agree with that. The AirPods are not noise canceling. They kind of don't seal outside noise, and that can be good or bad depending upon your situation. Some people like the fact that they can hear what's going on around them. But if you're looking for something different, the Braggy Pros, they actually have the ability to toggle on or off their noise cancellation, which I think that's a really neat feature. So you can have the best of both worlds, but again, a little bit pricier. If you want something that has similar pairing technology, because a big advantage in my mind of the AirPods is not having to deal with the whole Bluetooth pairing issues that a lot of other devices have. A couple of you recommended the Beats X headphones. So the Beats X from Apple has the W1 chips, so you get all of the syncing advantages. The main difference is that they do have the wire between the earbuds, so they're not the truly wireless style of the AirPods, but they're the same price, $150, and they do offer different colors and also for the fit, different ear tips, because a few people did mention, you know, they just don't, the AirPods just don't fit my ears, that for whatever reason. I think AirPods fit a little bit better than Apple's EarPods, but I recognize too that they're maybe not a perfect fit for everyone, so that makes sense as well. And then if you're looking for another pair of truly wireless earbuds, another recommendation was the new Hira IQ Buds. These are about $299, and one of the cool features with these is that they have the ability to adjust the sound in each ear when it comes to the noise cancellation or the enhancements, so that you can actually hear speech more easily in a noisy environment. So it sounds like these would be pretty good if you tend to take phone calls or do conversations, as well as listen to music with your earbuds. So thanks to everybody who sent in all of that feedback and for those recommendations. Links to all of these will be in the show notes at maccast.com. We have a question from a listener. I think last week we talked about moving your iTunes library. I had the question about, you know, how do I move my iTunes library? Well, this week I got another iTunes-related question, this time from Danny.
Hey, Adam. My name is Danny. I've been a listener of the MacCast for about a year and a half now, and I've really enjoyed the show and wanted to present a topic that I've been kind of struggling with. It's certainly not a new thing, but something I've been noticing more and more in my iTunes library. I've been an iTunes user for several years since I got my first iPod, started using iTunes Match right when that was first offered. That was a little rocky at first, but once they got the kinks worked out, it definitely got a lot smoother. Added on Apple Music as soon as that was offered a couple years ago, and then recently made the switch to completely get rid of iTunes Match, do everything through Apple Music. And generally, the experience is great. I can have all my music in the cloud. On my MacBook Pro, I have my main iTunes library, which I have local backups of, would always do a local backup before adding any of these services, just in case anything were to go wrong. Some stuff did go wrong the first couple times, so I'm definitely used to that. But one thing I've been noticing is certain tracks in my library have been replaced with really odd versions in the cloud. And I don't know if other users are experiencing this, if this is normal or not. Some really interesting situations. So one of them I have from a CD that I had ripped. It was the Eagles' Greatest Hits from the 70s. And my rip sounds great. Everything sounds fine. On the cloud version, like one of the tracks, Witchy Woman, the second track on the album, sounds terrible in the cloud. Don't know, understand why. I went and confirmed with my original track. Definitely is working well. It's something, I know, it matched really, really bizarrely up in the cloud. Another weird example, a Van Morrison song, Brown Eyed Girl, also from a CD I had, some 60s collection, apparently was replaced with a censored version of the song. I didn't even know that one existed. A particular line about the green grass is replaced towards the end. May have been like an old 60s radio edit, but certainly not what I have on the CD I have. And then our third example, really, really weird, from a track that I actually bought from iTunes, from Fits in the Tantrum's first albums. It's a song, Money Grabber. I bought the entire album from iTunes, I've had it there for a while, and one day the song comes on, and at the end there's this weird radio noise. Maybe it's like a stinger or something from a radio station, almost like this was a version that somebody had recorded off the air, and that's now what's in the cloud version of my library. And that's a track that's actually from iTunes, so it's really, really weird. And there's definitely a number of other tracks where censored versions have replaced the real versions from other artists too, but those were a few examples. Bottom line, I just want to know if you or any other listeners have dealt with weird anomalies like this in your own library, and what do you think is the best way to try to replace these things so that you can get the right versions back in line with all of my devices? Because as it is right now, I only have the real version on my Mac, but all my other devices, my iPhone, my iPad, and the other computers I have in the mix are going to get stuck with these replaced cloud versions. So just wanted to know if you had any feedback. Really love the show. Thanks so much, Adam. Bye.
Hey, Danny. Thank you for the comments and questions on this. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, and it doesn't do it for me too often, but I've had a track or two come up when I'm listening to iTunes in the cloud with an odd version that wasn't quite the original that I had originally ripped from my CDs. And I think anybody who has been using Apple Music for a while and using the iTunes in the cloud feature probably has experienced this or might know this. And I don't know what happens on Apple's end specifically to cause this to happen. I have some theories and we'll talk about that in a little bit. And I want to get to answering your question, but I do want to clarify a little bit how this stuff works and what you mean by replaced, because early on Apple Music and specifically iTunes in the cloud I think got a little bit of a bad rap, and I recognize that you understand this very clearly from what you were saying in your message there, but I want to make sure that everybody else listening really understands this and it's really clear. But early on it kind of got this bad rap, some people saying that it replaced everything that I ripped in my local library with these weird tracks or the wrong tracks or something like that. And that is not something that it does. You have great advice in your message there too. Before you turn on iTunes in the cloud or set up iTunes Match or any of this stuff, I would really recommend backing up and making sure you have a good backup of your iTunes library, specifically all of the stuff that you loaded in yourself. So whether that's MP3s or stuff that you ripped or whatever it might be, all the stuff that you already own, you probably want to make sure you have good clean copies of that before you turn this on. But then really what should happen is when you turn on iTunes in the cloud, and we are specifically talking here about the iTunes in the cloud feature of Apple Music. And this is the feature that allows you to let iTunes scan your local library, and then for anything that wasn't purchased directly from iTunes, it will find that music, it will try and match that with copies that Apple has on its servers, and then make that available through your Apple Music account to your other devices. So your other iOS devices, other Macs that are connected into the same Apple Music, iTunes, and the cloud account. But locally, whatever computer that you're sourcing from, in this case, it sounds like, Danny, it's your iMac, none of those files should actually be touched beyond the fact that it's going to go through and it's going to kind of scan those and try and, again, do some audio fingerprinting and matching with copies that Apple might have on its servers. So there's kind of three different versions of things that we're talking about. There's the local copies, and those will remain untouched. There's the stuff that is matched. So when iTunes or Apple Music finds what it considers to be a matched version of the track, what it does is basically unlocks that Apple copy and makes that available to your other devices. So nothing is sent into the cloud, nothing is touched on your local computer, it's just simply a matching algorithm, and then it's made available for you to stream or download to your other devices. And then for anything that it can't match, what it will do is actually grab a copy, upload it, and if it's not in 256 kilobit AAC format, it will actually convert it in the cloud online. Again, it won't touch the local version, but it will, for the copy that it uploads into iTunes in the cloud, it will convert it to a 256 kilobit AAC and then make that version available to all your other devices. So if you have obscure stuff that's maybe not in Apple's Apple Music library, it will actually upload it. And so that tends to be what happens more for folks who are audiophiles, for people who have more obscure versions of stuff. But again, if you also have more obscure kind of live versions of stuff, oftentimes that seems to be the stuff that it has a little bit harder time matching, where you might have a really specific edit version and suddenly you get the generic version, or like you mentioned, Danny, you have the, you know, censored version, but what it matches and what is available on iTunes Match is the censored version, and that's probably not what you want. Another common one that I know about is a lot of audiophiles like the old mono versions of Beatles tracks, and more recent versions have been remastered into stereo. So you'll have the mono version that's in your library that you ripped from your old, you know, your old CD or something like that, and suddenly the matched version that you're getting on your other devices, that's the stereo version, and that may or may not be what you want, depending upon you know, how you feel about these things. So the question then becomes is, you know, what can you do about it? And unfortunately, you don't really have much control over what Apple does with the matching algorithm, nor do you have much control over what versions of different tracks and things Apple has in the Apple Music library. And so I really wish there was kind of a way to force a version that you have, even when it's matched, to be uploaded so that it actually uses the uploaded version or uses your version from your library across all your devices. They don't have the ability to do that right now. I don't know why. There's some speculation it may be having to do with how the licensing agreement works and maybe the cost for things. I have heard rumors that Apple may have to actually pay more for you to be able to stream the tracks that were actually uploaded to their servers, because they don't know where those versions came from, right? So those could be potentially old pirated versions that came off of Napster or something like that, and the studios want to get a higher compensation rate just in case, you know, some of that piracy is going on and Apple may pay a little bit more every time you stream one of those. That's just one theory. I've never been able to find out if that's accurate or true, but it kind of makes sense to me that, you know, they could be playing that game with the whole licensing deal. But at this point, Apple is not allowing a way for you to kind of force your versions to be in the cloud versus the ones that are matched. You're kind of a victim of their algorithm. Now, one thing on the matching side that I have dealt with where I've gotten an odd match is going back and making sure that the metadata that I have on my local files is all filled out and is accurate, and more specifically really matches in terms of the artist name, the album title, and the song title. It matches the information that Apple has in Apple Music. And the easiest way that I found to do this is go into my iTunes library, right click on the track. So if you have one of these tracks that's getting a weird version from Apple Music, right click on that track in the iTunes library and choose under the go to menu in the contextual menu, song in Apple Music. And then that should take you right to the track in Apple Music. And then just compare that information, compare what Apple has for the name of the title of the track and the artist. And, you know, sometimes I found little things like where I might have a hyphen and then part of the song in a track, or song title in a track, and Apple has that same information in parentheses or something like that. Little weird stuff like that where it's just off by a little bit. Now, more recently, I think Apple has switched to an audio fingerprinting system for the matching, so this may or may not work anymore, but it's worth a shot. So just make sure that as it appears in Apple Music, it's the same way you have it in your local library. And then after you make those metadata adjustments, you can go under the file menu in iTunes under library and try update iCloud Music Library and see if that doesn't fix that connection. I think in a lot of cases it's not going to do much, again, because I think they're using the audio fingerprinting, but it's worth a shot. And maybe I've had it work for me on a couple tracks, not too many. Beyond that, there's one other workaround that I discovered and read about. I've actually heard about this. And the idea here is that you tweak the audio track, your local copy of the audio track, in a way that would force iTunes Match to not be able to recognize it. So you basically mess with that audio fingerprint. Now, you're going to want to do this on a copy of the original track. So again, make sure that you have a good backup of this before you do it. And I will link to a discussion thread on Apple's discussion boards that has the specific step-by-steps and including some software that can help you actually do this. But basically, there was a guy on there and he discovered this technique. And the idea here is you make a copy of the track that is not being matched properly and you tweak it in the audio file, but maintain the metadata. So the whole key here is you don't want to mess with the metadata because you want that to be maintained in your file, but you filter the audio file in a way. In his case, he uses a bit of software that basically reverses the audio track, like puts it all backwards. And then he uses that to let Apple Music try and match it. And of course, in that case, it can't match the audio fingerprint. It can't figure it out. And so then it will attempt to upload the file. And then what he does is basically quickly swap the file in that instant so that what actually gets uploaded is the real actual track. So the idea here is you make the copy, you tweak the audio file, and then you add the tweaked audio file to iTunes. And once it's in iTunes, you right-click on it and you say add to iCloud. And you probably want to have your good copy open in a folder and ready to go, because you have to do this little swap thing. And another very important thing is you need to make sure that the file name is exactly the same on both versions, the tweaked version and the good source version. And so after you click add to iCloud, you're going to wait, and as soon as it says sending information to Apple or whatever it says that shows that it's sending the kind of audio fingerprint to Apple, you want to copy the original correct file and replace the gibberish one in the iTunes media folder. So you swap that out, and what will happen is Apple will return back to iTunes a no match signal, which is the signal to iTunes to say, okay, upload this file into my iCloud library. And what should happen at that point is that good correct copy will get uploaded into iCloud music library, into your iCloud music library. And then it should be fixed. And then all of your other devices that tap into that should be getting the uploaded version, not the version, the bad matched version from Apple. Unfortunately, this is a track by track kind of solution. So if you have a lot of music that's messed up, this may not be ideal. But if you just have one or two tracks, this may be the only way that I know of where you can kind of trick it into using your version versus the Apple Music version. So not a great solution, I think, unfortunately, for you, Danny, but maybe something that can help out. And then one final thing to note as far as why this might be happening, or just something else you might want to try. My guess is that Apple has a highly automated system for doing all this, and a highly automated system for actually adding audio tracks that they get from the record labels or whoever to the iTunes library. And it may be the case where they just get a weird version that came directly from the source, and that just ends up getting ripped or digitized or whatever and put into the iTunes music, you know, into the Apple Music library. We're talking about millions of, you know, I don't know how many millions of songs at this point, I can't remember, but a ton of songs and tracks. And Apple, I don't think, has somebody going through and listening to and verifying every single one of these. So it is possible that they don't even know that they have a weird or odd track in an album or something like that, and then it's getting matched weirdly. So what I would suggest is report those bad tracks to Apple and see if they get fixed on their end. Apple has a feedback mechanism you can use. So what I would do is, again, if you find a bad track or a mismatched track, go into iTunes, right-click on that track, and under the Share Song options, choose Copy Link so that you get a link to it in Apple Music, and then go to Apple's feedback website, apple.com/feedback, and click on Apple Music, and then fill out the form. And I would select probably the, hey, this is a broken feature option under the feedback type. So just say broken feature, explain the issue with the track and why you believe it's the wrong audio track, and then just paste the link to it in the email and send that off to Apple and just let them know, hey, there's something wrong here. There's a weird track on iTunes. I don't know why it's matching weird like this. It's not what I have in my library. And that way they're aware of it. And if it's a problem with the matching algorithm, maybe they can tweak that. Or if it's a problem with the actual audio file, they can go back to the source and maybe get the correct version. So I would try all of those things or a combination of those things, Danny, and I hope that helps you out. And maybe some of you have some additional ways of dealing with this. And if you do, shoot me some feedback, send me an email or an audio comment, mattcast@gmail.com. The final thing I have for you today is another couple questions from Martin. It's a little bit of a grab bag, but specifically something that I think will help out some of you who are considering upgrading to the next iPhone. So he has a couple questions about that and a few other odds and ends, and we'll try and answer all of those. So here's Martin.
Hey, Adam, this is Martin in Virginia. I've been a MacCast subscriber for years and appreciate all the good information and entertainment you provide. As a follow-up to your recent comments on the new iPhone, I'm following your advice to buy an unlocked version outright, and I've got a few questions. Will I need to go to my local Apple store to get it set for Verizon? And if I follow you and end up over at AT&T in the future later, will I need to go back to Apple to get it changed over? If I go to a carrier directly, will they put a spell on my iPhone so it can't get changed in the future to another carrier? And now for the lightning round. In 1Password, when you export the whole data file, it mentions it's unencrypted. Is that safe to store on Dropbox or on a flash drive? And finally, when making backups using SuperDuper and Time Machine to an external hard drive, does it matter whether you use one of the desktop versions or a portable one? Appreciate all the answers. Thanks again. I'll be listening. Bye.
Hey, Martin, thank you so much. Those are some great questions there, and I think they're going to help out not just you, but some of the other listeners as well. I know it can get confusing when you're trying to buy an unlocked iPhone. I've been doing it for a couple years, and as you noted, I really prefer it. I think it's a great way to go. You're not all locked into a contract, and you kind of have freedom to move around. Just a little bit of clarification. I am currently on AT&T, although I will tell you this week, I just ordered up my new SIMs. I'm going to be making that move to T-Mobile that I've been talking about, and I'm excited because I'm going to be saving quite a bit of money over my current plan. And I will report back on how the whole experience went on future episodes and also talk to you guys about my experience in terms of coverage and quality of service and stuff like that. I know some people are concerned about that. I can only share my personal experience here in Southern California, and I know it varies from region to region, but I'm going to do my best to kind of keep up on that. So I'll let you guys know how that goes. But that kind of freedom is one of the reasons why I buy my phones outright. It was great to be able to tell the person, the agent on the phone, yep, you don't need to worry. I don't need my contract paid off. I don't need anything other than just send me the SIMs and I'm ready to switch over. And if it turns out to be horrible, I can jump right back to AT&T. There's kind of no problems moving around because you're not stuck under that contract. So personally, I think it's a great way to go. I understand that not everybody wants to make that choice, and I don't knock anybody for going on the plan. It's just, I think it's a great way to buy your iPhone if you're able to do it. Now, as you pointed out, switching, though, can be a little bit tricky. Oh, let me answer the first question, which was, you know, can you just buy it from Apple? Do you have to go into the carrier? What's going on there? Basically, when you buy your phone from Apple on day one, either in the retail store or online, they're going to ask you which carrier you want your phone on. So you just simply tell them, I'm on Verizon, I need a Verizon phone, because there are a couple different versions of the phone, and this is going to come into play when I answer the next question. So hold on for that. Basically, you're going to say, this is my carrier, and then on the payment, rather than being subsidized, you're just going to pay the full price, but you're still going to get that phone. Now, the important thing to know about that is that means the phone typically is locked to the carrier. So it is carrier locked. Now, it gets a little bit confusing because you're not under contract. You're fully able to move to another carrier, but you will have to get that phone unlocked from their network. And I'll explain a little bit more about the how and why of that here in this next section. So the second part of your question was, okay, are they going to, if I do get a carrier phone, are they going to put some mojo on it and kind of lock me out? And the answer there is yes, typically. There's an exception to this. But yeah, if you go in and you buy a iPhone 8 on Verizon, it is going to be locked to Verizon's network. Now, you're not under contract and you can move away, but when you want to go move away, you are going to have to get them to carrier unlock the phone. Now, luckily, that's pretty easy. It usually involves a phone call or just going on a website saying you want to unlock your phone. And as long as your payments are all up to date in your contract and you have paid outright for your phone, they should just unlock it for you. And then at that point, you can take it to whatever carrier you want. Now, here's the other area where you need to be careful. In your case, you mentioned being on Verizon. There are actually currently, and I don't know if this is going to be the case with the iPhone 8, but at least with all of the iPhones up through and including the iPhone 7, there are two different versions that have two different cellular modems in them. The Verizon and Sprint versions support both GSM and CDMA networks, and I believe they use Qualcomm modems in the iPhone 7 models. For the iPhone 7 models that are the AT&T and T-Mobile versions, those use Intel cellular modems and they only support GSM networks. So if you want to make a move from Verizon to AT&T, you could do that with a Verizon Sprint phone because both of those support GSM. But if you had an AT&T or T-Mobile phone and wanted to go the other way to Verizon or Sprint, you would not be able to do that because it's missing the CDMA portion of the spectrum. So they can't go on the CDMA network. So you need to be careful when you're buying your phone and telling them which carrier version you want. Now, Apple does sell a carrier-free version, and that's the good option to get if you can get it. The problem is historically, Apple has not sold the carrier-free version for pre-orders or early on. It's usually delayed a couple weeks to a month or two after launch, and I'm not entirely certain why that is. I believe the model that they sell as carrier-free and sort of add your own SIM later, I believe that's just simply the Verizon Sprint, the GSM CDMA model. And that's why you can take it from carrier to carrier. So I'm just bringing this up because even if you're planning to activate your phone on AT&T or T-Mobile, I don't know that you can do that if you buy the Verizon and Sprint phone. And here's why. I think that, again, those phones are carrier locked out of the box, and you would need to have an account with Verizon or Sprint to be able to call them up and do the unlock procedure. So you can't just simply, if you're already an AT&T customer, go in and buy the Verizon Sprint phone and then activate it outright on AT&T or T-Mobile. I believe that's the case. I haven't had to do that specific scenario, and it sounds like you don't have to do that, and I'm sure the audience will let me know if I've gotten that wrong. But there is this unlock procedure you typically need to do to free it from the carrier network, unless, again, you get the carrier-free version directly from Apple. And if you can do that, that, I believe, is already carrier unlocked. I know it's all very confusing, and probably a lot of this only applies to phones in the U.S. I think it might be a little bit different internationally. We have this weird thing with the carriers sort of locking our devices, and it's a big pain in the butt, and I wish it was just completely done away with. But at this point, at least with the current phones, it's not. Now, again, I don't know if this is going to change with the iPhone 8. There is a report that what was going on with the Intel modem as far as being GSM only, it was because they did not have the licensing for CDMA technology. Supposedly, they have that now, so the new modem may be a true, what they call a world phone, regardless of. There might only be one model of iPhone that covers all of the carriers, all of the bands, both GSM and CDMA. We'll have to wait until Tuesday to actually find out for sure. So that's the answer to the first couple questions that you had. Now on to the 1Password question. The answer there is emphatically no. If you have exported the unencrypted data file, it is open to the world. If someone were to get a hold of that, it is not safe. It's not encrypted. They would have access to all of your passwords, all of your data, everything that is in. It's basically a text file at that point. So it's about as good as opening up the Notes app and just copying and pasting all of your account logins and passwords in there. 1Password offers that feature so that you can easily move from one device to another, or you could share a password if you wanted to, but that's why they throw up that warning saying this is unencrypted. If you are going to store that file, you're going to want to encrypt it in some way or store it encrypted in some way, and that doesn't include just uploading it to Dropbox. You would have to encrypt it first. Now, on Dropbox's servers, I believe all your files are encrypted. But I know that Dropbox, I think, has the keys for that, and they can decrypt that. So if they were compromised in some way or something like that, I think you could potentially be exposed. And again, if somebody were able to get access to your Dropbox account, they're going to have full access to your 1Password database. So I wouldn't do that. The thing is that 1Password itself, the data file that it stores, is obviously heavily encrypted and protected. And they do offer, if you're using their subscription service, they do offer their own secure syncing. So all of that's encrypted. So if you just are looking to sync your database between your various devices, you can use that. And they also do allow you to use third-party services. I actually do all of my 1Password syncing with my Dropbox account, but through 1Password. So you want to enable that inside 1Password and let 1Password put that data file, that encrypted data file, up into the cloud services. So you can use Dropbox or iCloud, or I think they even have some ways that you can set up your own server if you want to be fully in control of all of that. But you can use their encrypted database file and have that sync, and that would be safe. You would be able to be stay protected and encrypted doing that method. So I hope that clears up that question. And then finally, on your last question, for doing backups like Carbon Copy Cloner or Super Duper or Time Machine, does it matter if you're using a desktop or a portable drive? No, it's really a matter of price or design and convenience, really is what comes into play here. Desktop drives tend to be larger. They also tend to need an external power supply, so you have to plug them into power. A lot of times they have a big wall wart, but they tend to be less expensive on a per terabyte level. So if you need storage, you want to pay a little bit less for backup. Desktop drives are generally a great way to go. Portable drives, much smaller, easier to move around. A lot of them are bus powered, so you can just plug them into USB. You'll have one cable. You don't have to have a separate power cable, but they do tend to be a little bit more expensive. Not a lot more expensive, but a little bit more. And so for me personally, I like to use portable drives. It's really just a personal choice. I like the idea that they're bus powered. I like the idea that if I wanted to take a backup with me, or specifically I use it for like my iTunes library, if I want to take that with me on the road, I can do that, and I'm not going to have to carry a bunch of extra cables or a big power supply or something like that. So that's the reason I do that. The only other thing I'll comment on, you know, picking backup drives these days, if you can afford it, it's very expensive to go this way, but if you can afford it, going SSD, solid state, can give you better performance, and also SSDs tend to have more reliability against like mechanical failures, right? There's no moving parts, so they tend to be a little bit more robust if you drop them, specifically if they're portable drives, less chance of something, you know, being wrong with the data actually on the drive. Obviously, if you crack the case or, you know, break the connector, that's a different scenario, but you get the point. They're a little more robust. They can offer you better performance. Now, some people will say, well, SSDs, they have, you know, write limits, and, you know, that could be a problem if you're using it for backup. That has kind of been disproven. It's been proven that SSDs, modern SSDs with the latest technologies in them and software and stuff, they can handle write cycles used in backup. The one thing to note is they don't necessarily have a longer life than traditional spinning hard drives. Again, they're eventually going to wear out. It's just a different sort of wearing out, and they tend to have about the same lifespan. So typically we talk about, if you get a good quality drive, it can be anywhere from 2 to maybe 5 years before you need to potentially replace that drive. If you heard my story, you know that I had a bunch of drives that were right at that range, about 5 years old, and they all started failing all about the same time because they were all about the same age. So that's not really going to change with SSD. What changes with SSD is that initial chance for failure. They tend to be a little bit more robust in the early days. So just make a note of that. I mean, the ultimate thing to know is that with any hard drive, it will eventually fail. It's not a question of if, it's really a question of when. When will it happen? And you never know. I mean, there can just be weird situations where something just goes bad and it fails right away, or you could go years. I've had hard drives that have lasted, you know, 10 years and are still up and running and going just fine. So you never really know. And that's why we do backups in the first place, right? And that's why we have multiple backups. We don't rely on one. Make sure it's in at least three places if it's really critical, and have one of those places be somewhere in the cloud or offsite, somewhere where it's not susceptible to fire or theft or some sort of physical thing happening to the drive. But hopefully that answers all of your questions, Martin. And with that, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth on the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like me to talk about on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can also leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype username is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me online, social media, I have Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.